Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. I've told my audience, and you are my audience, that I'm going to begin every day until Thanksgiving reading out loud the powerful words of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings. This is what Vindman said. It is a powerful statement from a civics perspective and from a patriot perspective and from what it means to be an American. The uniform I wear today is that of the United States Army. The members of our all-volunteer force are made up of a patchwork of people from all ethnicities, regions, socioeconomic backgrounds who come together under a common oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. We do not serve any political party. We serve the nation. I am humbled to come before you today as one of many who serve in the most distinguished and able military in the world. The Army is the only profession I've ever known. As a young man, I decided I want to spend my life serving this nation. It gave my family refuge from authoritarian repression. For the last 20 years, it has been an honor to represent and protect this great country. Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer life. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself, and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history and story in America. I also recognize that my simple act of appearing here today, just like the courage of my colleagues who have also truthfully testified before this committee, would not be tolerated in many places around the world. In Russia, my act of expressing concern to the chain of command in an official and private channel would have severe personal and professional repercussions. And offering public testimony involving the very president would surely cost me my life. I am grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where we can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. It is proof that you made a right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union, to come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. As he finished that testimony and statement, the New York Times put out a story that said the military is so worried about Lieutenant Colonel Vindman's safety and the safety of his family that they're thinking of moving him to a military base. God help us. This is what Trump has created. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Scott Braddock, the voice of Texas, the editor of the Quam Report, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. Be right back. Welcome back to the Friday edition of The Attitude. As promised, Scott Braddock, the editor of the Quam Report, the voice of Texas. So I got to ask a couple of questions. So Where were you giving a speech, number one? And number two, tell my audience where you are parked, because I want people to understand that we tape the show on Thursday morning, so it'll air on Friday. But you were always in interesting places and in interesting transit. You know, you don't live in Houston, but maybe you're hanging out in Houston. You live in Austin, but maybe you're like some other part of Texas. And Texas is the size of a nation, so I can't even imagine your life. All right, so tell me about your speech first, and then you've got to share with my audience where you are, because I think this is even more hysterical.
You can't understand Texas unless you travel all of Texas. When I used to work here in Dallas, where I'm talking to you from this morning, I was at CBS News, and sometimes the CBS News desk in New York would call us in Dallas-Fort Worth, and they would ask about some news event that had happened maybe in a place like El Paso. And Arnie, I would say, and they would wonder, are we sending a reporter to El Paso from Dallas? And I would tell them, no, you should call Los Angeles. They're closer. They're physically closer to the Pacific Ocean in El Paso than Dallas. If you drive from Austin to Dallas-Fort Worth, it's about 3.5 hours. To continue on to Amarillo in the Panhandle is another 6 hours, okay? Are you getting a picture of this?
I'm getting a picture of it.
Right. One other fact on that. It's further from Beaumont in East Texas to El Paso than it is from El Paso to the Pacific Ocean. That's how big and wide Texas is. We like to brag about that.
Well, let me just say something.
So I travel all over this place. Yeah. Houston, Dallas, Amarillo, East Texas, Odessa, down to the valley, wherever. I put a lot of miles in my truck, and I like to talk to people all over the state and figure out what's going on. Yesterday, I was in Denton, Texas, which you and I have talked a lot about, this idea that the suburbs are the new melting pot.
Absolutely.
Right? Everyone, we always heard about white flight, people living in the cities, leaving the cities, and now they've made their way to the suburbs, exurbs, et cetera. And Denton County, along with places like Collin County, Fort Bend County, Williamson County, these are the new battlegrounds. And what's interesting, Arnie, to me, and I was thinking about this yesterday, as I was talking to the Denton Republican Women's Club there, a very engaged group. They had a bunch of great questions. I don't think they'd agree with you on every issue, although they might agree with you on some things. But what was extra interesting to me is these places are, I think in my conversations it was revealed, these places are going to be battlegrounds both in the primaries and in November. And so I wonder how this is all going to shake out, Arnie. How many bank shots are going to happen in this pool game before we figure out where all the balls land? And you have sort of the right-wing Republicans who are challenging who they call the rhinos in the March primary. And in the room I was standing in yesterday, two candidates for the Texas House were listening to my speech. They were in the back of the room. One of them was formerly a candidate supported by third-party right-wing groups like Empower Texans, which we've talked a lot about, that group that went
after the speaker. That took down the speaker of the House.
Shady, dark money group. But now he's a rhino. Now that guy's a rhino. because he's not doing 100% of what those groups want him to do.
Exactly.
Right? We've seen this over and over again.
Exactly.
Where candidates will come in as Republicans. They'll be elected to the Texas House or the Senate or whatever. And then they don't do 100% of what those candidates or what those groups want them to do. And so suddenly they're the rhino. So now there's another candidate challenging him. But in that same area, in Denton County, this is where we saw, you know, some Texas House seats either be very close for Democrats in 2018, and one of them actually flipped from Republican to Democrat in that county last year. And the rest of the Republicans are worried that the same kind of thing's going to happen in 2020. And by the way, it really surprised some of these Republican candidates. I mean, you talk about maybe arrogance, not the right word, but if you don't really take it seriously that you have a race on your hands, you don't campaign the same way that you would if you really thought that you did, right?
So let me just stop you for a second. Let me just, because a lot of these districts are gerrymandered, so obviously it benefits the Republicans because that's why they do this. What I want to remind everyone is that this is the end of the decade of the gerrymander. And what that is that this is the weakest time for a gerrymandered district to be effective because people die, people move in, out, people grow in population. And as a result, what you got at the very beginning of the gerrymander is a very strong red Republican district. What you may have a decade later is something not quite so nuclear red. And I think that's the other thing is that their arrogance doesn't recognize that people move and change. And that over a decade, it could be a slightly different district than it was at the very beginning. And that means you have to live with the new people that are there, not just the old faces that you sort of banked on 10 years ago.
Love that on your show, we've always been able to kind of stretch out and you really give this issue the attention that it deserves and the explanation that it deserves. Another way to say what you just said, Arnie, is once they take the census data, which is what those districts are based on, once they take that census data, they use a computer program to, here's the way I put it, to optimize the districts for partisan advantage.
Exactly.
Okay, so you have Republican, like you say, ruby red districts. You have those Democratic districts as well. Maybe some districts might be drawn as swing districts, but probably not very many, especially if Republicans can, you know, retain complete control over the redistricting process here in Texas in 2021. To take it a step further, what you just said, some communities change faster than others, right?
Exactly.
In these places like Dallas-Fort Worth, and particularly in the suburbs, and in the suburbs in Houston, the growth has just been explosive. Remember, there are 1,200 or so people moving to Texas every day from other places, so many of them moving to the suburbs. I mean, there's some of the white flight that we talked about out of the cities to the suburbs. But it's also a lot of people just relocate from other states in the suburbs. And who are they? Are they Republicans? Are they Democrats? Here's an interesting data point. In the Cruz versus Beto O'Rourke race in 2018, if you looked at the polling data, because in a room like I was talking to yesterday, this Republican club, they assumed that all these people who are moving from California or wherever else are all Democrats. They're all liberals, and that's why we see the election results changing in Texas. But if you look at that Cruz and O'Rourke race, the polling suggested that those who were native-born Texans were trending for Beto O'Rourke, the Democrat, and those who had moved from somewhere else were trending toward Cruz, the Republican. So you do have a lot of people from other places who are Republicans, there are more Republicans in California, for example, than there are in Texas. They just have more people, right? There's just way more Democrats. But a lot of them see Texas as sort of a Republican mecca. It's among the reasons that some people move to Texas. Other reasons are just people moving here for a job, for the economic opportunities that are here. And so they're not necessarily moving for politics. So a lot of people are up for grabs. The great Paul Burka at Texas Monthly.
Paul.
He was the dean of the Texas Capitol Press Corps. He's now retired. But he often used to say that when people are looking for new voters, if there's a candidate looking for new voters, there's a word for that, loser. The deal is that the ones who are looking for new voters now in this state are Republicans. All of a sudden, all these Democrats came out of the woodwork. In 2018, we had 8.4 million people vote in this state. That's presidential-style turnout, Arnie. I don't know how many people are going to vote in 2020. I think we have north of 16 million people registered in Texas now, which is pretty good, by the way, out of a state of just under 30 million people. We've got over, you know, we're around half registered, something like that. So if people, you know, vote at a strength of 12 million, 13 million, what does that mean? About a month ago, President Trump was here in Dallas, American Airlines Center, and he was saying, don't worry, he was saying to his supporters in his speech, don't worry, Texas is locked down for Republicans. There is no concern. It's Rock Rib
just
Republican.
Like Kentucky.
At the very same time, Karl Rove was on a stage in Austin. I was there for his speech at the Texas House Republican Caucus meeting, and he was telling them that if current trends hold, Republicans will probably not elect the next Speaker of the Texas House. Democrats will do that. Because if you look around the state, in those suburban places, like Denton, where I just was, and in Fort Bend County and other places, it's trending for the Democrats. And so Republicans need to change up the way they're doing these elections, number one. And one of the ways that they're doing that, number two, is to try to find new voters. Are they going to be successful? We'll see. But they are pouring millions of dollars into that effort. I'm told, Arnie, the sort of the complete combined effort to try to find new Republican voters, they're going to spend something like $13 million. That's what they're trying to do right now.
Now, where is the money coming from? Is the money coming from the governor? Is the money coming from the Texas Republican Party? Who's looking for these voters, and who's cutting the checks?
That's the right question. The Republican mega donors in this state have stepped up in a big way.
Okay.
The first report from one of the groups that's involved in this showed about $10 million, and it was that money was coming basically from the normal business interests who give to folks like Governor Abbott, for example, people like Ross Perot Jr., people like some construction magnates from Houston, et cetera.
So it's not the dark money groups that's doing it at this point.
One of those construction guys, a guy named David Weekly, who is also the head of a group called Texans for Lawsuit Reform, which was the group that spearheaded tort reform in the United States, which you may know of. Google the movie. Well, you can watch it on YouTube, Hot Coffee.
Yeah, I've seen it. It's great.
You've probably seen that. So that a lot of that's based on the work the Texans for Lawsuit Reform did. And they are trying to figure out how they can find new Republican voters. One of the things to say about it, Arnie, in this this quest to find money to support the Republican majority in the Texas House, was just revealed this week that our old friend Karl Rove, the strategist who helped, the guy whose nickname was Turd Blossom, and was sort of the original Roger Stone, as far as his tactics, the dirty tactics. You might remember Karl Rove was the guy who came up with the scurrilous rumors about John McCain in South Carolina having an illegitimate black baby, and then McCain would not even shake Bush's hand when they were going to debate there. Karl Rove has now been tapped as the strategist and treasurer for a new political election committee aimed at preserving the Republican majority in the Texas House, and they are aiming to raise at least about $5 million to try to shore up their resources. We should say the backdrop for all this, of course, is a scandal with the Speaker of the Texas House, who would normally be the person to do all this.
Right.
Yet usually, when Speaker Joe Strauss was there over the last decade, it was part of what he would do is gather funds and resources, and his political operation would call the shots on how to support Republican candidates across the state to preserve the Republican majority. And it was groups like Empower Texans, Texas Right to Life, and these other affiliated organizations that were always calling Strauss a rhino. They were always calling Strauss not conservative enough. They were the ones who were telling us the new speaker, Dennis Bonin, was going to save the Republican Party and was going to be the true conservative Republican speaker. And then what happens? Those same groups take him down you know, and the scandal with the tape that we've talked about many times on the show, and now there's a vacuum of leadership in the Republican Party. Usually it'd be the speaker organizing this, you know, sort of the general, you know, who's, you know, commanding the troops across the field. And if a candidate over here needs more resources, they line that up for them. Candidate over there doesn't need as much, they don't, and that sort of thing. So they can take a global view of what's happening, you know, around the state and try to manage the campaigns that they're happening and support campaigns. So there's no one to do that now, so all these disparate groups are trying to figure out how they're going to move forward.
So I've got two things I want to say. Remember, we were talking at the very beginning about how at the very beginning of the decade, the gerrymander is much more efficient and effective. But by the end, because of movement and change and people dying and whatever, it's a very different district. Just to give you an idea from a New Hampshire perspective, because I saw this the other day, and one of the big complaints about New Hampshire primary is that we're too white. Well, we are very white. I mean, there's no question about it.
Very white.
Very well. But
Julian Castro very upset about that.
Well, tell Julian.
And Iowa too. All these white people.
Well, but something's happening. I want to just give you a little nugget of information. This is to protect my primary, sorta.
It says
the number of minorities who call New Hampshire home has doubled in the past 18 years, and now one out of every 10 Granite State residents is of a racial minority. Now, I think it used to be maybe one out of every 15. So, I mean, we're now one out of 10. So, 10% of the population now, and that's significant. And let me just say something. I have visually seen that on the playground across the street. I have to tell you, you can tell that there is a change. And obviously the change doesn't come statewide. It usually comes in the cities. But we really are seeing a difference. But that, again, reinforces that what you saw a decade ago is not necessarily what you see today. I do have to ask a question, because we're talking about the fact that the Speaker of the House used to be the person to organize all this kind of activity. We now know that your Speaker has decided to not run for re-election. So my question is, who looks like they may be emerging to step in? Is your former Speaker Strauss doing anything from outside the system in order to maybe help coordinate what goes forward in 2020?
It's a good question, Arnie. I think Speaker Strauss, the former presiding officer, has something like, I want to say something like $8 million in his account. You know, he was the Speaker of the House, so a lot of people, you know, stepped up with campaign donations for him, and a big question is, you know, what's he going to do with that, if anything? Of course, he could use it to run for some other office in the future if he chose to do so personally. I did see on his Twitter feed over the last week, and as I've been traveling around Texas, looks like he's been traveling around as well.
Yeah, I thought so.
He was supporting some Republican candidates in San Antonio, Houston, Abilene, and a few other places. I saw he was tweeting out pictures with various candidates. It's kind of interesting to see him stepping into that role of saying he's supporting this candidate and that candidate when that would normally be the actual, you know, current sitting speaker. But I don't think anybody wants to be taking pictures with him right now after he disgraced himself and really embarrassed the Texas House of Representatives. I will say by trying to trade my media credential to a dark money organization in a plot to go after other Republican members. It just sounds crazy to say that out loud. By the way, I told this group of Republican women in Denton yesterday because people had asked, well, how'd your summer go, Scott? And my answer was simply that, well, the Speaker of the House tried to melt down my career, but only one of us had to quit.
You are brilliant. You are brilliant. Now, I just, you know, as I'm listening and I'm thinking about former Speaker Strauss, I see him as playing a really important role, which is like the senior distinguished statesman. And in some ways, his reputation has been enhanced because of what just happened with the current speaker, which I think is very, very useful. And that is a very actually powerful role, and sometimes more powerful than actually being the speaker, because you really are able to both step back and step in. And I think in the end, he will be a valuable player going forward in 2020. And he doesn't necessarily have to run for anything to still be able to understand how to move the right chess pieces.
Well, and I think that if the Republican majority is preserved in the state, it'll certainly have, you know, not everything to do with, but something to do with the fact that the former speaker, who is, by the way, respected by people who are swing voters and independents in the state, he's going around and saying that certain Republicans need to be reelected. And for some of the Republicans he was talking about and with, they're in safe areas like in Abilene, Texas. I don't know the exact number, Arnie, but I'm going to guess that the Republican candidate in Abilene gets more than 70% in November. That's probably right. I know for a fact that in Amarillo, which isn't too far away, but is West Texas. I think in November, the state senator for Amarillo got 88%, but who's a Republican. Those are very safe areas, yes. However, the former speaker Strauss was in some areas, certain parts of Houston, certain parts of Dallas, mm-hmm. where I think those districts are questionable going in November of 2020. And so he is stepping up and trying to protect those Republican members. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
Okay, real quickly, just because I want to get into a couple of other political things, but I want people to get a sense of your environs. So you are now parked in a parking lot. And tell I want you to tell my audience this because, and again, we need to have the flavor of everything. And Texas isn't just you and your pickup truck, you know, smoking your cigar, talking to these Republican women's group. It's also where you're parking right now, which also will give people a sense of, God, I think I need to at least visit Texas.
I'm leaving Dallas, and I pulled over on the side of the road here to talk to you on my way back to Austin and pulled into a parking lot. It's something that I've seen many times in Houston, Dallas, and a few other places, but particularly in these two cities. That is a Korean restaurant, Hot Stone in Korea, it's Kitchen, mm-hmm. And which doubles as a donut shop. And I've seen a lot of particularly Korean and Vietnamese immigrants in Houston and Dallas who, you know, they run at night. For lunch and dinner, they run a restaurant, a Korean restaurant. But in the morning, it's also a donut shop. You know, the people, and you know,
It's brilliant.
Part of it is, Ernie, these people never stop working.
Yeah.
You know what time you have to get up in the morning to make donuts?
Yeah.
It would probably be right after you would have gone to sleep after cleaning up at a dinner place, right? So, you know, some of the most hard-working people.
Exactly, the work ethic.
Especially in places like Southwest Houston, which is nothing like what it was when I was a kid. Southwest Houston, the Sharpstown area, people can look this up, was sort of, the Sharpstown was the first master plan community in the United States, I believe. I'll double-check that, but it's among the first. And that was, you know, a big, affluent white area. Sharpstown now is one of the most diverse places in the United States. It runs right into Fort Bend County, which is the most diverse county in the United States ethnically. We've just seen these huge immigrant populations coming in. And this is the thing about something that divides our politics and our reality in Texas, because those aren't always the same thing, Arnie.
Yes.
While we have been putting up a sign that says immigrants are not welcome here with things like Senate Bill 4, which is Show Me Your Papers bill in 2017 that was pressed by Governor Abbott. At the same time, Texas has a long history, in Houston in particular, of welcoming the immigrant, welcoming people in from all, and by the way, also welcoming those folks who are refugees from various parts of the world. Wisdom High School, which, this is interesting, Wisdom High School, which I believe was the high school that they featured on the Anthony Bourdain Houston episode when he traveled to Houston. It's the high school that is home to more refugees than any other high school in the United States, from places like Iraq and Syria, et cetera. And think about how things have changed. It's now Wisdom High School.
Mm-hmm.
That used to be Robert E. Lee High School in Houston.
This is a movie. This is a movie. But I just want to comment on the Korean restaurant that becomes a donut shop in the morning.
Yeah.
When you told me that story, I couldn't stop smiling because I went to school. I went to school for a short period of time in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and I went to the University of Minnesota. And one of my favorite places was an Italian restaurant called Mama Rosa's. But at about 3 o'clock in the morning, it got cleaned up, and in the morning it became Breakfast at Mama's. And I remember thinking, when I grow up, I'm going to do exactly the same thing. And again, this is both about efficiency. It's about an incredible work ethic. It's about the diversity of population. Remember, these are Italians in the Scandinavian twin cities from the 1970s. So they were diverse back then. And I just love this story because this is our strength. This is our strength. What new folks who come here, these immigrants, you know, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, all these people, what they bring is so important, and they make us better. They make us better. That's the part I just go crazy about. Before I let you go, I only have like 2 minutes left. I want to ask one quick question. So we know that Representative Hurd is not running again for re-election. What's the rumor on the street in Texas? Where is he going? Right now, he seems to be rubber stamping President Trump. I mean, everything I've been hearing from him through the hearings doesn't seem like he's sort of accepting anything that he at least is hearing from the people from the State Department, the ambassadors. But I'm kind of curious because I'm a little surprised by that given his history and his background. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, what are we hearing that he's looking to do?
Among the Republicans who have announced their retirements, some of them have stepped out a little further in their criticism of President Trump. But as you said, Hurd has been sort of towing the party line in these impeachment hearings, which I find interesting. And the Republican Party at some point is going to have to grapple with what they are after Trump, you know, whether that means after he's maybe removed from office or after he just loses the next election or if he serves two terms and then he's just done after that. Mm-hmm. But what are Republicans after that? Are they just the party of Trump? When it comes to Hurd, we don't know exactly what he's going to do next as far as him personally and his career. We have seen that he's planning to or may have already launched a group aimed at electing Republicans who are sort of like-minded Republicans, particularly in Republican primaries. But he's been a little cagey about exactly what he might do. And, of course, there was some talk about him maybe running for president, but who knows.
Okay. On that note, I need to let you go, but I want to remind everyone that when we come back for the Friday edition of The Attitude, we're going to be talking with Lisa Curry. She is a reporter for The Washington Monthly. Her piece, A New Lebanon, How the Lebanese Uprising is Helping a Divided Nation Form a Cohesive National Identity. What I love about our Friday show, Scott Braddock, who I adore, is that we give people stuff other than the impeachment, other than the 2020. We give people a sense of a flavor both of our country and our world. And that's why I so value your voice. We can't wait to talk to you next week. Thank you so much.
Tell her about the Asian restaurants with the donuts in the morning.
I promise. All right. Stick around, everyone. We'll be right back. Thank you, Scott.
Don't you know that talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper? Don't you know that talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper? While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds whisper. Who are people gonna rise up and get their share? Who are people gonna rise up and take what's theirs? Don't you know you better run, run, run. But a revolution, yes, finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution, oh no. Talking about a revolution, oh, while they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for.
Talking about a revolution. Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. So I regularly check the Washington Monthly. And once again, Lisa Curry, who is a phenomenal reporter, wrote a piece entitled A New Lebanon, How the Lebanese Uprising is Helping a Divided Nation Form a Cohesive National Identity. Despite the fact that we're going through impeachment hearings, despite the fact that we're going through a 2020 debate series, despite the fact that the U.S. feels like it's the wheels are falling apart, I think we need to understand what's happening around the world, especially in places like Lebanon. So, Lisa, before I have you comment on your article at the Washington Monthly, I just want everyone to know that I went to your website, and I was just so inspired. It opens this way under the About. People worldwide called me ugly, mentally unstable, and compared me to Hitler. Did they call you, Lisa Curry, all those things? She's a freelance producer and reporter who obviously cares about issues that are sort of affecting the world. She has investigated in places like Syria and checked out the Palestinian refugees. She's written for Al Jazeera, Vox, Washington Monthly. But I'm just kind of curious. It did catch my attention. But has anyone actually referred to you this way? I can't even quite comprehend it.
Oh, they've referred to me as worse than that.
Oh, my God. Well, I'm glad you're back in the States and you're safe. But we talked to you a couple of weeks ago about the Syrian refugees in Lebanon, and it was a compelling interview and one that made me realize so much around the world I'm not paying attention to, and that not only do I need to be aware, but so does my audience. So talk to me about the Lebanese uprising. And what I think is so fascinating is that, as you point out under the subtitle, it is helping a divided nation form a cohesive national identity. So talk to me about what's leading to this uprising and why different factions are finding unity as opposed to sort of division.
Yeah, so first of all, thank you for having me on again.
You're welcome.
And I'd love to tell you about this uprising. And also, I just want to let people know that as Americans, I think there's a reason they should know about it, and there's a reason they should care. And I think it really can impact us here in America. So we'll get to that.
Okay. Well, first start with the story of what's happening and how it is actually creating more of a sense of unity than a sense of division.
So this all started on October 17th. The Lebanese government announced a slew of new taxes, and for the people of Lebanon, that was kind of the final straw. And what's happened every single day since is hundreds of thousands of people, sometimes in the millions actually, have taken to the streets to protest against their corrupt government. We've seen uprisings across the Middle East in the last decade. You know, we've seen it in Egypt, in Syria. But what's so different about the ones happening in Lebanon is these are completely peaceful. And this revolution is actually bringing the people of Lebanon together across all religious sects, across all political affiliations. So it's quite inspiring.
You have in your piece, and I want people to understand that, you know, I'm offended occasionally by taxes, but taxes would not inspire me to take to the streets. And yet there is this undercurrent of corruption. And yet I want people to hear the dollar numbers and the reason why people are so disgusted. Because it would be one thing to raise taxes and to see benefits and to see services and to get something of value. What they're basically seeing is virtually nothing. And you write in your piece, for instance, salaries of government officials rose more than 7.5% each year in the past decade, according to a McKinsey report. The government spends 46% more on public servant salaries than peer countries like Jordan and Romania. At the same time, it generates 10% less revenue. And then, of course, this is when people really react. If you don't have clean water, if you don't have trash collection, if you don't have reliable electricity, then people notice not only are they paying, but they're not getting, and not only are they not getting, but they really can't survive in a stable way. And as you point out in your piece, 40% of Lebanon's electricity is produced by private generator companies, which make nearly $1 billion a year. So here you have instability. Here you have high taxes. Here you have an unstable electric grid. And yet at the same time, we know people are making money. It's just not being reinvested in Lebanon.
Right. So to put it quite simply, for the past 30 years, well, probably more, but for the past 30 years since Lebanon created this political system, all the benefits go to the politicians, and ordinary people are really suffering. And it's very hard for them to not only get jobs and live a stable life, but they don't have reliable electricity. They don't have clean water. They don't have trash pickup. And they're literally living amongst trash when their politicians are living really lavish lives.
Yeah, exactly. And if nothing, if nothing sort of gets people to go to the streets, and at the same time, here's the sort of good news, bad news. Everybody has unreliable electricity. Everybody's trash is not getting picked up. I mean, obviously some very affluent people. But as a result, what you find is the lack of services, the lack of reliability, the idea that you're all being asked to pay taxes and not seeing any positive consequences for this, that can get people angry, but can also offer people Velcro because they realize they're in the boat together.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think what people have realized in Lebanon is they've been divided for 30 years. So to give a little bit of context, in 1990, after the Lebanese Civil War, the country decided to create a government that would give equal sharing to each religion, the majority of religions in Lebanon. So you have the president always has to be Maronite Catholic, the prime minister always has to be Sunni Muslim, and the parliament speaker always has to be Shiite.
Isn't that amazing?
But since that time, each party has kind of created other parties, and now there are 18 political parties in Lebanon, and they've really divided people. And for so long, you've seen people just blindly following these politicians who are offering nothing but empty promises. And so years later, when you have young people coming out of college and realizing it's impossible to build a future for themselves unless they leave home, you have women who see their husbands 1 to 2 times a year because they have to leave Lebanon to work. You have children who are hungry. You have just a terrible lifestyle. People are like, you know what? These politicians who have, you know, been in power for so long have done nothing but divide us and have done nothing for our everyday lives. And so we're done. We're over it. And we want to create an uprising so that the goal is to pressure every single politician in power right now to step down. And so far, they've had some success. 13 days into the revolution, their prime minister stepped down. So now you have the president who's still in power, and you have Hezbollah that's still in power. And people are wondering, you know, is this going to turn into a civil war? If a party like Hezbollah, which is considered a terrorist group by the U.S. and by several other countries, if they're not willing to back down, then what are they willing to do? And so we're kind of just waiting to see what's going to happen with this protest movement.
So tell me about the role of Hezbollah in Lebanon. You mentioned that there were 18 political parties. They've divided themselves up into different factions. This is not good. Everybody's made promises and no one's delivered. You see the prime minister having stepped down, but the president is still there. I suspect the speaker of the house is still there. So tell me about Hezbollah. How has it infiltrated the politics of Lebanon? What is their role in Lebanese politics? And why are they so key in this conversation?
Hezbollah started as a militia in the 80s. They were against Israel during the Lebanese-Israeli war. And since then, they've really gained power, both militarily and politically. And now, today in Lebanon, they have the majority of seats in the parliament. Okay. And they are really a powerful political group, a mainstream political group, when it comes to Shiite Muslims in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
They have a huge following. So Hezbollah, of course, is backed by Iran, and a lot of people see them as an extension of Iran, especially the U.S. So the more power Hezbollah gains in Lebanon, the more power Iran gains in the Middle East, and they're considered a pretty big threat to the U.S. And so the U.S., we've seen, is invested in this situation in Lebanon because they don't want Hezbollah in power. They want to kind of see the protesters, I think, win this. And we've also seen Lebanon, we've also seen the U.S. freeze military aid to Lebanon because the military has had a bit of a violent, not completely, but they've been a bit violent toward protesters at times. Mm-hmm. And so the U.S. is freezing military aid to Lebanon, I think, because one can assume they want this protest movement to work and they want Hezbollah out.
So what has Hezbollah offered other than it has support from Iran, other than it has, you know, obviously some sort of strong influence? But what if we're talking about people being unhappy because they're being charged more and getting less, because there's lack of stability, because most people have to leave the country in order to succeed? I understand that Hezbollah is there. I understand it's got the support of Iran. But first of all, do the Lebanese want to be a tool of Iran? I don't think so. And if Hezbollah is gaining power, what is its power based on other than threats?
So for a while, it was just based on threats, but now because they're such a mainstream political group, they've actually established themselves in the Shiite community as political, as strong politicians. So we've seen in really poor Shiite areas of Lebanon, Hezbollah has helped the poor. They've provided jobs, they've provided food, and they've, in a way, kind of taken advantage of those areas to say, hey, you need us, mm-hmm. you know? We're strong. We have a strong military. We have a lot of money. You need us. And that can be really powerful when you're very poor and you're living in a third world country and you have this extremely strong group that's representing your religion and that's helping your poor people. You know, that can be really powerful.
So, Lisa, what I'm trying to figure out is this piece is sort of quasi-hopeful. And I'm trying to figure out, what are you really basing your hope on? Are you really seeing people coming together despite the influence of Hezbollah, despite the influence of perhaps other politicians with the other 17 parties? What gives you hope here, and what makes you think that this will be more successful than so many of the other uprisings we've seen in the Middle East? I feel like there's been waves and waves and waves, but I haven't seen a success strategy anywhere. Why would Lebanon offer us maybe a positive example of something that could work? What gives you this sense of hope?
So for the first time, we're seeing supporters of Hezbollah, we're seeing supporters of the president, supporters of the party, all these different religions and political affiliations coming together as one. And that has pretty much never happened before, not in Lebanon and probably not in the Middle East. Right. So I think the people on the streets of Lebanon remind us as Americans, you know, and as people around the world that it's citizens who have power. It's not politicians.
Yes.
It's the people.
Yes.
And it's in these moments of mass protests that kind of remind us, you know, when you act together and when you realize there's more that unites you than divides you, you can change things.
You know, it's so interesting, Lisa. As you're talking, and I think they're even singing songs now that talk about the unity. That it's actually they're trying to figure out all these ways of sort of reinforcing about the idea that we are in this together. This is not about being Christian. This is not about being Shia. This is about being Lebanese. You know, this is about living here. And when you have that opportunity, you really do begin to see that maybe new leadership can come forward. So who is helping not only to thread these different factions together, but where is the leadership coming from? Is it coming from the university campuses? Is it coming, or is it a little bit like Occupy Wall Street with no head, but lots of people coming together because of a sense of frustration? And as people say, Occupy Wall Street was not successful. I beg to differ. I think it actually was wildly successful. But, you know, people weren't looking for a certain kind of success. But when you see the kind of changes that are happening, including the progressive conversation that's happening within the Democratic Party, I go back to Occupy Wall Street as part of the raison d'etre.
Totally. I mean, I think that the protest movement in Lebanon has, like, similarities to things we've seen, even just frustrations here in the U.S. currently with the government. But as far as leadership goes, the protest movement in Lebanon purposely lacks a leader.
Yeah.
And there have been clear leaders. I mean, people I've interviewed on the streets who have tens of thousands of followers on social media, and they're posting things about where we're going to protest tonight and why we're protesting. And you have these young people, most of them are millennials, who are really leading this movement.
Yeah.
But they're making it clear that we do not have a leader. We are one. And they're trying to make a statement that we're protesting against the people who are leaders. And mm-hmm. that leadership is creating divisions in our country. So we're going to make a statement by saying we have no leader.
So I understand the leadership. I understand the fact that they don't want to have a leader. The idea is because all the factions are coming together because of their common experience and their common sense of loss and dissatisfaction, which is fabulous. As they're doing this, and you've already seen the prime minister step down, you said, What are their demands? What are they asking of the president? Do they want the president to step down? Do they want new elections? Because in the end, some of these people are going to have to be replaced. Who's going to replace the prime minister? If they're dissatisfied with the president, who replaces the president? Again, in the end, you have to recognize your power, but then you have to make a collective decision.
So this is a bit of a concern. I've talked to experts, I've talked to professors, and they're saying, you know, this is great that the protesters have this momentum and they've had some success, but what's next?
Exactly.
What are they going to do if everybody steps down, right? We don't want a power vacuum. That could leave room for somebody really dangerous to take over.
Right.
But what the protesters are hoping is that everybody will step down and there will be an early election so that they have a chance to elect new leaders. Now, will that happen? Probably not. With a party like Hezbollah in power, people are a little bit concerned that something more extreme would happen before they would be willing to step down. We've already seen hundreds of Hezbollah supporters attack protesters, attack journalists, so I don't think they're going to go down easily.
The first piece we interviewed you on was about the Syrian refugees being told to leave. My kind of question here is, and again, you know, obviously they're overwhelmed with the number of refugees and that's an easy group to blame. But when you look at all those numbers that you just shared with me about how, you know, their civil servants are overpaid, how they raise less revenue, how they're getting less services, that's not the refugees' problem. They didn't cause this. This is caused by rot at the higher level. How are they threading that needle? Are they still continuing to push refugees out as if somehow once we get them out, things will be better? Or are they beginning to recognize that even the refugees are part of this sort of cohesive group of people that really need to address the problems going into the future for Lebanon?
I think the Syrian refugee crisis has kind of been put on the side since these protests have happened. So much of Lebanese history, especially just recently, has had nothing to do with the Lebanese. We've seen cries out for help for the Syrians, cries out for help for the Palestinians in Lebanon, but the Lebanese are saying, it's our turn. You know, we're not worried about the refugees right now. We're not worried about how Iran is going to have power here or how Saudi Arabia is going to have their hand. No, we want our country back, and we want to build a future for ourselves. So the focus has heavily been on the Lebanese. Now, are the Syrians affected by this? Absolutely, because the revolution has really shut down the country. Roads are closed, banks, businesses, schools are closed. And when you can't find work, you have Syrian refugees living in tents who go out on the street every day and look for work, and there simply is none right now. So it's having quite an effect on the refugees. It's kind of just not really being talked about.
You write at the end of your piece at the Washington Monthly, and again, this is almost a repetition of what you just said, but I want people to hear it. For decades, Lebanon has been used as a pawn in other countries' political games, Syria, the Palestinians, Iran, I feel like, you know, it's just one chess piece. But what's springing in Lebanon is not an opportunity for other actors to gain power. It's the opportunity for people to get their country back. In the process, they are starting to form a new national identity. It's still early. We don't know what exactly that newfound identity will look like, but we know this much. The Lebanese people will be the agents of its creation. So I want to step back and ask you a question about this new identity. You mentioned at the very beginning that they did something very interesting about the power sharing. You know, the Christians, the Shia, that there were each different faction had a different representation. Now looking back on that, Lisa, was that good for the idea of creating a sense of Velcro and relationship? Or did that just sort of reinforce the difference?
You know, I don't know. Because could we have ever predicted that it would have created such intense divisions?
Right.
I don't know. On paper, it seems good. Because it seems like each majority would have some sort of representation in their government. But maybe now they realize that's not the most efficient way to govern this country. And maybe now they realize there needs to be some sort of neutral party in power that just looks out for ordinary people.
Well, you know, when people ask me, what am I? You know, I don't say I'm a Protestant or I'm an atheist or I'm an agnostic. I say I'm an American. And so the idea that somehow what happens is by the idea of the division of faith as a way of identification ends up, I think, in the long run, not being useful and beneficial. You're absolutely right. On paper, it sounded phenomenal three or four decades ago. But today, I just kind of look and ask the question, so if you're going to create your identity, is your identity your faith? Is our identity the fact that you're Lebanese? And that's going to be such an amazing challenge. Lisa Curry is a Washington Monthly contributor. She previously worked as a producer and assignment editor for Spectrum News in Buffalo. She's written for ABC, Al Jazeera, Vox, HuffPost, and the Buffalo News. And I can't imagine some of the things that you've been called, but what I'm going to call you is an excellent reporter. So thank you so much for doing this. And thank you for educating my audience and me on some of the stories that are going on around this world, because we have to realize, one, in some ways, the crazy chaos we're seeing in America, we are not alone. There is frighteningly a similar situation happening everywhere. Now the question is, can we find the Velcro to hold ourselves together? I hope you join us again.
Thank you so much, Arnie.
It's a pleasure. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks, Lisa.